Rewind is a production of Wisconsin Eye. To keep programs like this free and accessible to all, please consider a charitable gift to wiseye.org/donate or text WISEYE to 44321.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review, two Madison Democrats join the governor's race. Plus, a conservative Wisconsin prosecutor faces questioning on her path to federal court. And Governor Tony Evers issues an executive order to maintain vaccine access. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for September 19th.
I'm Ani Van Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Welcome to Rewind. Pretty busy week this week. We have not one but two new candidates in the governor's race, and not one but two Madison Democrats in that race. So this week, State Senator Kelda Royce and State Representative Francesca Hung both announced that they are running. Both Madison Democrats, but kind of in different lanes. Francesca Hung comes from the Socialist Caucus of the legislature. Kelda Royce has a longer kind of legislative background. What do you make of these two announcements?
Republicans are almost giddy at the idea of Democrats having a bloody primary for once. Now go back to 2022, Tim Michaels, Rebecca Clayfish, Tim Rantham, they had this kind of contentious primary. Michaels emerged somewhat battered by it, didn't spend more of his personal money, and then kind of had a hard time the rest of the year. Go back to 2012, Republican primary for U.S. Senate, Tommy Thompson, Eric Hovde, Jeff Fitzgerald, others running that primary. Tommy emerged broke, and Tammy Baldwin defined him quickly after the August primary. Republicans would love to see not just a Democratic nominee who's broke, but also been pulled to the left by this race, because mentioned Hong, Socialist Caucus, Kelda Royce from Madison. They are not going to run as moderates, especially Francesca Hung. She's made that clear. She's going to speak with a progressive voice. The question is, will the whole primary field go that way, or does it open a lane for a more moderate candidate like a Josh Call to win? History lesson 2018, Tony Evers was not the flaming liberal candidate in the primary, okay? He won 42% of the vote in that primary. Was it because his name ID? Was it because he got outside help? Well, because he raised the most money, Kelda Royce did, although she took out a second mortgage in her home to help do that. But, you know, Evers was kind of like the moderate, well-known person, right? So can a Josh Call, who's still thinking about things, become that more moderate alternative? Can David Crowley, who speaks to with credibility to the Milwaukee business community, can he be that moderate, you know, candidate? Then also is Mandela Barnes out there in the wings. If people keep telling me if Josh Call runs, Mandela probably doesn't. If Josh Call doesn't run, Mandela probably does. Oh, by the way, if Josh keeps taking his time, Mandela might run anyway. Then there's Sarah Rodriguez. Can't forget about her. Like, where's her lane? So we've got this crowded field. I'm waiting to see, though, who's finally in, like, in. It's all said and done. And then how does the debate emerge? I mean, also, let's be honest, primary voters, do they pay much attention until the very end? You know, are they really going to plug in and now like really dive into policy? My impression is they're all going to be, all the Democrats are going to be anti-Trump. They're all going to support abortion rights. Then what else can differentiate them? That's kind of a big question. Oh, and who can raise the money? That's a driver. We'll know in January probably who's been successful at that, but who can raise the money and get a lane of his or her own that really stands out? That's the big challenge for those guys.
And you raise the point that they're not necessarily going for 51% of the vote, that whoever emerges in August could very easily do that without getting a majority of the vote. And so I'm really curious to see kind of what kind of coalition building is going to take place. And for somebody like Francesca Hung, you know, it's been about 80 years since there was an elected socialist leader in the state of Wisconsin. And so is she trying to just pull the party to the right? Is she running a campaign where she really is trying trying to kind of bring in more moderate voters, or is this really about sort of message setting? So that'll be really interesting. We are also waiting to see a possible announcement, I should say, from Tom Tiffany on the Republican side. He teased an event for next week.
So Wednesday, save the date. It's a flyer that a lot of people got their hands on. Tiffany's overlooking this body of water in northern Wisconsin, which are boats running fists in the air. Save the date for an event on Wednesday. It's at an event barn, wedding barn type facility in Wausau. I looked up the address. So you don't do that just for the heck of it. All signs have been for a while he's going to run for governor. So there's always a chance he won't. He'll decide to stay in the House, but it looks like he's getting in. And I've heard all my Republicans sort of told me they've heard from him or people around him he's going to get in. The question is, what's taken so long? Is he just lining up donor support to pull the trigger, or what's going on? But there's also two ways about it. He's kept people intrigued this entire time. Every time he says, oh, I'll decide next month, it's a story. So to his credit, he's gotten more attention. Bill Berrien, a new digital ad this week, again, wrapping his arms around Donald Trump. Josh Shulman's out there working the trail. But, you know, Tiffany gets in, assuming he does, probably the front runner right away in that race. Oh, I can't forget about the Democratic primary. Francesca Hong raised 100 some grand in the first 36 hours after her launch. Kelda Roy said she raised $75,000 in the first 24 hours. Now, those are not huge amounts of money, but for Hong, it says she's got excitement. She's got this kind of youthful energy, and I'd say that I'm so old, but she's got this kind of thing going where people connected with her rollout video. And the message she's pushing. So she's going to be a factor in that primary.
Right. What she told me was, you know, she's not running from the right or the left. She's running for the working class, and she's really touting her background in the service industry compared to some of these other candidates who are really promoting their experience in the legislature, in elected office. Another couple of things, we're talking about these kind of domino effects of, okay, so if Josh Call does announce, then that opens up the race for AG, and so that's its own kind of separate thing. Depending on what Tom Tiffany does, Mary Felskowski may or may not consider a run. So there's all these kind of dominoes. We're also, Missy Hughes is stepping down from the Wisconsin Economic Development Council. I believe her last day is officially today. Right. She announced it last week. So that opens that question of whether she will consider a bid. So again, lots of open questions. And a reminder, we are 11 months out from the primary election. And as you say, I think even voters are not quite plugged in yet, but we sure are.
Yeah.
Another thing that's been kind of taking place this week is the nomination hearing for the Seventh Circuit. So can you just quickly remind us, what is the Seventh Circuit? What has this process been like getting to this point?
So it's a Chicago-based Court of Appeals. There are seats reserved for all the states in that district. This is a Wisconsin seat. Diane Sykes, former state Supreme Court Justice, is taking senior status on October 1st. It's kind of like a semi-retirement. You're still getting paid. You can still hear cases, but you're not supposed to be doing like a full workload. So President Trump has nominated Rebecca Tableson for the seat. She is a U.S. assistant U.S. attorney in Milwaukee, you know, clerked for Justice Kavanaugh before he became a Supreme Court justice, worked for the Trump administration at DOJ. Like, she's got this conservative background. But this kind of, like, conservative pushback has begun. So there was a statement out on Monday, I think it was, 50-some conservative figures said basically they have questions about her credentials. Is she conservative enough? They pointed to donations that she's made. For example, she gave a donation to a judge in Waukesha County appointed by Governor Evers, a Democrat, who then lost her bid to retain the seat. They identified a donation through Act Blue earmarked for Joe Manchin out in West Virginia. Her husband is a Democrat. Heaven forbid. That's a horrible thing. I started to be a little mocking there, but, you know, he's a Democrat. He worked in the Biden administration. He worked for Mayor Garland. He gave to Joe Biden. They're saying, we're not sure about this person. Is she conservative enough? They want a rock-ribbed conservative on this court.
Right, so a lot of the kind of questioning was around this idea of, in a mixed marriage, a politically mixed marriage, you know, could she maintain her conservative credentials? And so one of the things that she talked about during testimony was, she referred to Charlie Kirk. She said, I was raised in actually the best tradition of Charlie Kirk, to relish debate, you know, prove me wrong. And so my husband and I do have law and policy debates, but it works for us because we have so much else in common. And so she talked about, you know, her marriage being a place race where they had this kind of back and forth and some amount of conservative, priority differences, but pointed to her background, clerking for Kavanaugh, as you mentioned, clerking for Scalia. She has also support from conservative groups, but it's been very interesting kind of watching this conversation as well. Her Jewish background has been sort of part of this testimony. And the fact that she's aligned with a temple in the Milwaukee area, which doesn't necessarily have conservative beliefs. Mm-hmm. And so there's been this kind of conversation around maybe ideological purity, let's say, during her hearing. And it was interesting to see Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois, not a person who's particularly supportive of her nomination, but basically saying the religious questions are off the table. Like, that's really inappropriate.
And in talking to people after her testimony, the feedback I got was, look, her only real worry is if President Trump pulls back and says, hey, I'm not happy. Now, he did nix a nomination for somebody in June, I think, or late May or early June, because this person had given to Democrats. Didn't know about it before. She doesn't have a deep history of Democratic donations, right, or a couple here. But as long as President Trump is still on her side, she's probably fine. Plus, there's another big mistake that comes up, because you think about it, Democrats are likely not going to support a nomination of almost any appeals court judge Trump puts forward. Tammy Baldwin, for example, has not indicated her support for Rebecca, even though the commission she created with Ron Johnson identified her as a candidate for this post. So Democrats likely not getting on board. The only concern is if Republicans abandon her. And Ted Cruz defended her during this hearing, like really kind of praised her for her defense of Kavanaugh a few years ago when he was being going through the ringer with the confirmation hearing. So people tell me Republicans are not going to abandon Trump. If Trump wants her, she's fine. But if the president goes, nah, this is too much, then that may probably be a problem for her.
And it's, you know, it's coming at a time that we're having this conversation around free speech again because of the assassination of Charlie Kirk. So I just want to throw to some video of her discussing, again, what it's like to kind of be able to hold sort of multiple ideas, even as she has these pretty staunchly conservative background.
55 conservative groups signed a letter opposing your nomination. And they raised concerns that I think boiled down to a concern that you're secretly a closet liberal and that you'd be an activist on the bench.
I went to a Jewish day school, and I think it felt like we were the only conservatives at our Jewish day school in the 1990s. Especially back then, if you were Jewish and conservative, you had to really mean it. And we did. And my parents raised us to be proud of those beliefs and to be proud of those differences. I think my service in the United States government has been fully consistent with those values. I know that a lot of the concerns are about my husband. And it is true that my husband and I don't agree about everything in politics or the law. But my husband and I do agree about what it turns out are more important things in day-to-day life.
Right, so talking about just, you know, the way that they want to raise their kids, the way that they live their kind of family life, that is the thing that unites them. And so it's interesting kind of seeing how these personal matters and political matters kind of play out in this moment and to see what kind of support she will or won't get moving forward.
Yes, absolutely.
So that takes us now to another kind of personal slash political debate, which is the question over vaccines. So this week, Governor Tony Evers signed an executive order essentially saying that he was ordering all relevant health agencies to continue making vaccines accessible to the fullest extent of their authority. This obviously comes as there are big changes at the federal level. HHS under RFK Jr. has changed, for example, the recommendations for who receives a COVID-19 vaccine from anyone over 6 months to anyone over 65. And so that has made it so that in certain places your insurance might not cover or pharmacies might not make vaccines available. And so at the state level, a number of Democratic governors have tried to see sort of what is under their authority to make those vaccines still available. So this was Governor Evers kind of joining with these other Democratic governors to do that. In his announcement, he said that RFK and the Trump administration are inserting partisan politics into healthcare and the science-based decisions of medical professionals and are putting the health and lives of kids, families, and folks across our state at risk in the process. So one of those directives includes, you know, telling insurers to keep covering the vaccine to the extent that they are able to. And then DHS this week said that they will continue to recommend it for everyone over 6 months and continue to kind of share information about the safety and efficacy of vaccines.
And there are some limits to what Evers can do if this administration. So you mentioned that the directive to cover it if to the extent they can. So The Office of the Commissioner of Insurance issued a bulletin this week telling people, like, we want you to keep covering without charging a copay. The issue is that doesn't apply to if you get your coverage through Medicare, Medicaid, those kinds of programs. They can't tell them you have to cover the shot. If you get private insurance, they recommend you contact them if you have a problem. They can't really dictate to a lot of folks. You must. There are some places they can. But my point is, if you want the vaccine, if you're denied it for whatever reason or can't get it covered, your best recourse is to contact OCI. And I can't promise I'll resolve it for you, but that's what they can do with the powers they have.
And so one of the other kind of points that the Evers administration made was that all of these changes at the federal level sow confusion. And so part of what you're even talking about is this idea of something that may have been pretty routine for people every fall is like you go and get your flu shot. Now there's all these kinds of questions about where can I get it and what will be covered. And this is also coming, you know, as the CDC, their vaccine advisory committee, is meeting, I think, literally as we are speaking, to go over vaccine recommendations. This is an existing committee, but entirely new members. The previous members of this committee all fired by RFK Jr. and replaced with people who possibly align a little bit more with his own vaccine skepticism. So we will continue to see a lot of changes, I think, on that front going forward. Moving back to the conversation around Charlie Kirk and the kind of ongoing response, legislative response to that, we saw a couple of bills introduced at the state level, circulated at the state level this week, one about free speech on college campuses, one a resolution to honor Charlie Kirk, and then at the federal level, Representative Derek Van Orden introduced a bill that would strip federal funding from communities that, in his words, condone and celebrate political violence and domestic terrorism, also a response to Charlie Kirk. So what are you making of some of these resolutions?
Let's start with the Van Orden one. Probably some First Amendment issues there. We'll interest see if it even goes anywhere in the House. At the state level, the freedom of speech bill on campuses has been introduced before. It's basically coming back with a new push of, hey, here's an example of why we should do this. We'll see if it goes any further than it did last time.
Yeah, the Derek Van Orden thing I think is really interesting because a number of conservative and libertarian groups responded to it saying that this is unconstitutional. It also came as Attorney General Pam Bondi came out and said, you know, hate speech is not free speech. That's pretty famously not true. Hate speech is free speech. We've seen that, you know, even here in Wisconsin 2 years ago, there was a neo-Nazi march in downtown Madison, which was sort of deplored but protected. And so we are seeing this kind of conversation around what is free speech and what are the consequences of free speech in response to the Charlie Kirk killing, people losing jobs over expressing either, you know, support or just sort of expressions against him or his politics or what he stood for. So there have been these consequences, but part of the conversation is, you know, what are consequences and what is a violation of someone's First Amendment rights.
And Van Orden is personally promising to go after Eau Claire and Ellsworth because of stuff he's seen on social media. So Ellsworth, a teacher, posted something he found offensive about Charlie Kirk. He posted on social media sometime over the weekend or Monday that there are great people in Ellsworth except for this one. If this isn't rectified, kind of paraphrasing him, I will seek to cut off funding to Ellsworth, like all grants, it's everything. Eau Claire, there were a couple of common council members who made comments about Charlie Kirk on social media. Same deal, threatened their funding. So there is a PFAS cleanup facility, like $20 million, I think it is. They got a $2 million grant. Now that, so the way grants work tonight is the federal government is you don't get the money up front, you apply for it after you spend the money. They have not applied to be reimbursed, according to the Common Council president. He's threatening to go after federal funding. Emily Berg, who happens to be running against for the nomination to challenge Van Orden next fall, this is inappropriate. She also put out a fundraising letter pushing back against him. So just an example of where Van Orden is now. He has been on a tear on social media since Kirk was killed, saying, I'm going, these people who criticize him, they should be shunned, fired, etc. He's trying to put it into action with the people he represents, going after funding in the federal level.
Yeah, so it'll be really interesting to see how that plays out. And again, on that state level, looking at universities and to what extent this, again, protects free speech on universities, there's also been a push at the state level to basically make the UW campuses safer for conservative voices. And so to what extent will this be, you know, part of that conversation in the coming months will be really interesting. Mm-hmm. We also saw two lawsuits get filed this week, one against Madison, this ongoing kind of fallout of the 193 ballots that were lost in the November election. So a class action lawsuit was filed by the sort of pro-democracy, liberal law firm Law Forward on behalf of 8 of those voters whose ballots were not counted, saying that the city defendants, so the clerk's offices and people tied to the clerk, were responsible for counting the votes of plaintiffs and all class members. They had the opportunity after the election to ensure these votes were included in the certified state canvas, that they were counted. They didn't do that, and they are essentially saying that those people whose votes weren't counted are entitled to monetary damages, and they are calling for a jury trial to deal with this.
Telegraphed months ago, I think in March, they filed notice with the city that we're going to do this. Not a surprise. They're seeking like $175,000 per person. The cap on damages in state law is $50,000, so kind of watch that. But we'll see how this plays out, but it's not really surprising they filed the suit because they telegraphed it several months ago.
Right, and it's sort of arguing that these people were disenfranchised, so and they are seeking both damages to deal with that. And then also there was a lawsuit filed before the state Supreme Court, the ACLU essentially asking for the practice of ICE detainers, so Wisconsin jails who will hold a person who's been arrested on unrelated charges if they are found to be undocumented for additional time in order for sort of ICE to get involved. So it names Walworth, Brown, Kenosha, Sauk, and Marathon County Sheriff's Offices as respondents. This is really interesting, in part because it's filed before the state Supreme Court. Typically, the Supreme Court says, you need to file before a lower court. We don't want to hear things kind of straight up. But this is on behalf of Voces de la Frontera, which is an immigration rights group based in Milwaukee. And again, we've seen a lot of legislation around this practice of ICE detainers. Some communities affirmatively do not practice them. Some affirmatively do. When people talk about sort of sanctuary communities, this is one of those issues that is used to kind of define what that is. And we've also seen sheriff's groups come out, not necessarily against it, but when they've testified for information only with some of these proposed laws, what they say is it's a huge amount of resources to keep people in jails in order to comply with these detainers. And so it's been, an interesting political conversation. We haven't necessarily seen it play out in the courts in Wisconsin quite yet.
And what the petition argues is that, you know, once you've arrested somebody, right, the first time, if you honor the detainer request, you are arresting them a second time without authority to do it. So I often am not a lawyer, but that's the crux of the lawsuit, that it's a second arrest not authorized by state law.
Yeah, so that'll be interesting to see play out. And again, even whether it'll stay at the high court or get kicked around, these things always take quite a bit of time. Sort of final topic this week, it was the state of education address. And obviously, this has been a controversial issue between the two parties. So Jill Underley came out and essentially said that there are bullies from the federal government. And let's take a look at some video of her talking about that.
At a time when we should be uniting to support our kids, our educators, and our schools, we're instead seeing attacks driven by nothing more than political agendas and hatred. Because instead of being a true partner, the Federal Department of Education is using critical funding as a bargaining chip, threatening or withholding it with little or no notice, while demanding compliance with unclear and unlawful demands. Will we be the generation that looked away as our schools crumbled? Or will we be the ones who stood up, kept our promise, and chose to write a different story? Because the next chapter is unwritten. The pages are blank. And what happens next? That's up to us. So let's move the fence. Let us choose to write a better story for our kids, for our schools, for the Wisconsin we believe in.
Right. So obviously, there's been this kind of ongoing back and forth from the federal government trying to freeze funding. At one point this summer, an estimated $72 million in federal education funding for Wisconsin was frozen. Most of that has been unlocked. So that's essentially what Underley is talking about when she talks about those kind of federal attacks. In response, Devin LeMahieu, Senate Majority Leader, said the state of education in Wisconsin can be summed up in one word: unaccountable. Underley's changing standards, making it impossible for parents to track their students and schools' performances year over year.
Yeah, I mean, basically, the whole sort of pushback has been she's not talking about the whole picture of how kids are performing on these tests and in schools, and there's a problem there.
Yeah, so that brings us to the stock picks for this week. Rising, we have Turning Point USA, Charlie Kirk's organization. There's been sort of an outpouring of support in the last week.
So don't be crass in talking about this, right? A man was killed last week. You can't ignore the outpouring of support, the candlelight vigils on college campuses. I mean, there is something going on. The question is it sustainable politically? And again, I don't want to be crass, but let's talk about the politics, because always politics involved in these things. So Turning Point has been involved in Wisconsin for a little while. They have done turnout operations. Last fall, the perception when people I talked to was they weren't great at it, that Elon Musk group came and kind of saved the day to help President Trump win Wisconsin last fall. They were engaged this spring in the Supreme Court race. Obviously, it was a big liberal win. Is that their fault? No. But how good are they? We don't know. But for people involved in this movement, they see it as an opportunity to try and change things. When I've talked to some of them, they see Kirk's assassination like on par with like what happened with Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy. Like, this is their moment of like, this has really changed my life and has inspired me to be involved. But again, can it be sustained? It's a year from now until the primary, like, well, 11 months, 13 or so to the election. Like, that's a long time. I don't mean to be dismissive of young people, but like, can you stay engaged that entire time? That's gonna be a challenge for them, but you can't ignore the support. His wife is now taking over the group. They are gonna be a force in politics if they can sustain this going forward.
Well, and one of the sort of arguments always in politics is the political outcome and the sort of cultural outcome. And so even if this does create sort of a cultural turning point, it might be a little while till we see that kind of electorally play out. Yeah. So that'll be really interesting to watch. Mixed this week is Trevor Young.
Yes, so he's a Racine, former Racine alder, works the city now, announced for the 21st Senate District, which Van Wongard has, Republican, first elected back in 2010, lost in a recall election in 12, won it back in 14. Anyway, this is one of the four seats to pay attention to the Senate next fall. So Republicans have an 18-15 majority. There are four seats that have any chance of being in play, barring a miraculous wave one way or another. Of those four, one's held by a Democrat, three by Republicans. So for Dems, win any three and you've got the majority. Keep Jeff Smith and win all three, you're really happy, right? If you look at the numbers, and that's how Democrats look at these seats, on the numbers, the Democrats are in good shape. Last year, in a not great year for Democrats, Kamala Harris won more votes in all four seats than Donald Trump did. All right? You hate to predict things, but past his prologue, the party part of the White House struggles in midterm elections. Therefore, it should be a decent year for Democrats next year. How good, we don't know. So on the numbers, again, on the numbers, these should be seats that Democrats would probably win. I'm not going to say definitely, but probably. Add in the other numbers, the money. The Democratic Party has been much better raising money than the Republican Party has. They probably have an advantage. Republicans look at the person, the candidate, the quality of the candidate. So Van Wongard has run before and won. He's been in tough races, like the recall election in 2012. They feel good about Van running against a guy who's, no offense, but he's quite young. You know, there's a big difference in their age. Now, that brings another question about Van, right? He hasn't said what he's going to do next fall. He's going to take time to talk to his family and decide about whether to run, but the seat's changed. It used to be Western Kenosha and Racine counties. Now it goes Racine County, then north into Milwaukee County, the suburbs. Different seat for him. He's also 73. Like, again, no offense to age, but there have been talks about Governor Evers, Joe Biden, like Donald Trump. There's an age discussion out there going on. So how much of a fire does Van Wongard have? Republicans feel good about it. They think he's fired up. Go over to Howard Markline, southwestern Wisconsin. One, there are three Dems in the race right now. There's a primary that could take resources. Two, Howard has run above the top of the ticket before. Again, on the person, they like, you know, him. Go up to Jeff Smith's seat. So now Jesse James and Jeff Smith were drawn the same seat on the new maps. Jesse then moved into a different district to represent that now. The seat he was elected to before, if he goes back to where he was before residence-wise, he could run against Jeff Smith. Republicans like the person against Jeff Smith, right? Now, the one exception kind of is Rob Hutton. Not against, nothing but Rob as a person. It's the district. Back to numbers again. That's suburban Milwaukee district. Robin Vining is in that race. A couple others have announced as well. Numbers-wise, that's a really tough one for Republicans, especially in the Trump age. Like, suburbs have just not gone well for them. Now, could Rob win? Absolutely. My point is, on the numbers, Democrats feel really good. On the candidate quality, Republicans feel good. Which is going to win out next year? Generally speaking, from a macro level, people on both sides say the Senate, most likely this chamber to flip next year. But again, you drive down these individual districts, you can see a path for Republicans to hold on, maybe by their fingernails, in the Senate next year.
So definitely something to watch there. And then falling, speaking of vaccination rates are falling.
So new data out. They're down in Wisconsin the last few years. It's been a continuing trend. It's been spreading. Now the question is going to become, what's the impact going to be? And oh, by the way, health officials say what's going on in D.C. with RFK Jr. and his panels is not going to help the situation. Now, obviously, there's a debate going on about how safe vaccines are. There's a wing of our electorate that says these are not safe, I don't want them. But we're seeing outbreaks, a disease that were basically kind of wiped out before. That could be a challenge for us going forward. The question becomes, will it change? And what's going to happen to our health in Wisconsin and the country with this dynamic going on?
And then to what extent, you know, your access to vaccines is determined by where you live, and then what the kind of state versus national breakdown stays in Wisconsin could also be affected by the outcome of the governor's race in a year. So again, all of these kind of ongoing dynamics.
It's one more example of how we're becoming two countries. It depends on where you live, what kind of college education you're going to get, what you're taught, what your grade school education, what vaccines you can get. It's becoming two, not just a red and blue state, but a red and blue country.
Well, and on that note, we will wrap up for this week. I am Anjivan Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
See you next week.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.